Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Nolan. Good morning, everyone. Happy Sabbath. You know, it was just a few years back when people started coming to the services of the Church of God. They used to memorize certain scriptures. That would help them catalog verses so they could have a deeper understanding of God's plan of salvation. Now, one of those scriptures was 2 Timothy 3:16. You don't have to turn there. I would like to say it was a memory scripture, you know, so should be no need to turn there. I'll read it for you, though. All scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness. Now, as we began to study the Bible when we first came in the church, you know, it sometimes seems difficult to read some passages. And you scratch your head and you say, how does that fit in with being profitable for doctrine, or for reproof, or correction, or for instruction in righteousness? And so as we deepen our study of the Bible, we sometimes get caught. We say, I don't quite understand that. For example, a lot of times when you're reading through 1 Chronicles, it's difficult sometimes to see how all that begetting fits in with what we read in 2 Timothy 3:16. And so we sit there and we say, well, what does it mean when I'm reading this particular section? I think most of us have had an experience where you read a familiar passage and then you read it again and you say, I don't quite remember it being that way. I don't quite remember what it said or did say like that. And it makes us go back sometimes and read that verse again or that section of scriptures once again and say, I don't remember reading that. Well, that happened to me just a few weeks ago. I was doing some research and I came across a story that I thought was a very familiar story to me. Read it many times. I've even spoke on it. But I think I'd like to go back today and rehearse this story because there's a very powerful punchline, if you will. So let's turn in Genesis chapter 37 of the book of Genesis. Genesis 37, and we'll begin in verse 2. Genesis chapter 37 verse 2 says, this is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Well, Dan and Naphtali were the sons of Bilhah. And that she was Leah's maidservant. And the sons of Zilpah were Gad and Asher. And Zilpah was Rachel's maidservants. And it says, again reading in verse 2, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now, as you read through the Bible and do the research and so on, you find out that the Bible gives us absolutely no idea what that bad report was. But that's not the punchline I want to talk about. We'll come to that very shortly. We don't know what it was all about. There have been commentaries that try to explain what it might have been, and some of those commentaries, you know, give a plausible reason for what it says there, that there was a bad report given to Jacob. Well, as we see along, we go along, we read that it certainly get the idea that whatever it was, it did not render these four brothers in any way to be fond of their younger brother, Joseph. whatever it was. It just didn't work. Now, I've entitled the topic or the sermon that I'm giving today, Brotherly Love. And there's the first indication that there might have been some rivalries there, something that precluded these brothers from having the kind of love that they could have had, maybe should have had. And so it's depending on us that to have that kind of brotherly love. That's where we're heading. It says in verse 3, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. Now some of the commentaries say that Israel, Jacob, was about 90 years old when Joseph was born. And there was one mother child to be born. He was the firstborn son of Rachel, who was Israel's favorite wife. Remember, he was the one that he thought he was going to be marrying when he was tricked into the marriage with Leah. Well, it says verse 4, and he made him a tunic of many colors. Now, the King James and the New King James agree that that's what it says, a coat of many colors. But doing the research, you can check some of the translations, you'll find out that it was more descriptive of what this coat was by some of the other commentators. Now, if I were to compile a description of this coat that he made, it would read something like this. It would read like this. A coat he made was multicolored, long-sleeved, a coat that was very beautifully and elaborately embroidered, and so long that it reached down to his feet. Now, King James, New King James don't say all that, but it's obvious that this coat was distinctive. And apparently, none of the other brothers were given a coat like that. No record of that in the Bible. And it says in verse 4, but when his brothers saw that their father loved him, Joseph, more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now, Adam Clark wrote a very popular, well-respected commentary on the Bible. He finished that back in 1826. And so when you read Adam Clark's commentary, sometimes the phraseology is a little dated. What he is implying in his commentary of this verse is that his brothers wouldn't even say hello to him. I observe people coming into services every Sabbath, and there are hugs given and handshakes given and so on. And people are ready to say, hey, hi, how are you? How was your week? What's been going on? How are you feeling now? There's a feeling of familiarity and a feeling of love, not hatred. So here's Joseph, kind of an outcast among all of his other brothers. And in verse 5 it says he had a dream. And he told his dream to his brothers and they hated him even more. Brotherly love was not even a topic of consideration. So he said to them, well, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf rose up and stood upright. And indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. And his brothers said to him, shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? It says they hated him even more for his dreams. Love kept being shoved out. They hated him for his dreams and for his words. That wasn't bad enough. He had another dream. And it says that I dreamed another dream and he told it to his brothers. And he said, look, I've dreamed another dream. And this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. Well, this time he also told his father in verse 10. And his father rebuked him. And he said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? Now, one of the things you should bear in mind at this point in time, Rachel is already dead. She's already dead. So is this a prophecy about something's going to happen in the future? Maybe there's some things hidden in the story of Joseph. And his brothers envied him. They didn't love him. They envied him. But his father kept the matter in mind. So now we come to the point in the story where Joseph is sold into slavery, going to be sold into slavery. They have come to hate him so much that the sight of him was something that did not trigger love, but triggered hatred. Now, Joseph's father sends him on an errand out to check, see how the brothers are doing, not grazing their cattle and their flocks. Well, it took a little bit of time for Joseph to find them because his brothers had moved from where he thought they were to new grazing areas. So we drop down to verse 18. It says, now when they, his brothers, saw him afar off, or even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. That's how much they hated this young boy. 17 years old, and they're going to hate him. They're going to kill him. And they said to one another, look, the dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit. And we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what becomes of his dreams. The New Living Translation is becoming very popular, and it renders these few verses this way. When Joseph's brothers saw him coming, they recognized him in the distance. As he approached, they made plans to kill him. Here comes the dreamer, they said. Come on, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns. We can tell our father a wild animal has eaten him, and then we'll see what becomes of his dreams. Now, how did they know that this was Joseph when they saw him coming toward them? Let's read on. Reuben heard it, what the brothers were saying, verse 21. And he delivered him out of their hands and said, let's not kill him. Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. This is what Reuben was going to do, save him out of that pit. And so it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped him of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. And I would submit for your consideration that they spotted him afar off because they recognized that multicolored coat that Joseph was wearing. They knew it was him. And they had time to sit down and plot and say, what can we do with this boy? Boom. Several of them wanted to kill him. And of course, Reuben said, no, let's not kill him. Let's save him. His plan was not necessarily to sell him at that moment, but he wanted to save him and take him back to his father. So verse 24 says, they took him and cast him into the pit, and the pit was empty, and there was no water in it. So chapter 37 closes. We read that Joseph is sold for 20 shekels of silver. Judas, or Reuben's plan to rescue Joseph, is thwarted. His brothers stain that coat with that coat of many colors with the blood of one of the goats. And then they returned back to Israel, and they told him this lie that he had been eaten by an animal of some sort. Now, our story grows on now for 13 more years. Joseph has incurred the wrath of Potiphar's wife and wound up in prison. He correctly interprets the dreams of the baker and the butler. He correctly interprets Pharaoh's dream of the fat and lean cows. And he's released from prison after a couple of years and promoted to the position of number two man in the government, the prime minister, if you will. So we drop down now to Genesis 41. And we see the confirmation that 13 years have passed. Remember, Joseph was 17 when he went in out to look for his brothers. And it says in Genesis 41, verse 46, that Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh. Now, the famine that was predicted by the lean cows is in full swing. It's going on. They've had the years of feasting, 5 years, and now there's 2 years gone by. We'll see that a little bit later on. So Jacob tells his sons to go to Israel, or to Egypt rather, and buy some grain. We need something to eat, so go down to Egypt and get it. Now this is a journey apparently of about 250 miles. So it really wasn't something you could do over the weekend, because they had carts, they had oxen pulling the carts and so on. But anyhow, they did. They just took several things to go down to Egypt and get there. Now I'm sure when they got to Egypt, there were several protocols that had to happen within the government. They had to make application for food. They had to talk to various committees or department heads or whatever. But then they finally get to the guy who has the strings, that's able to provide the food for them. And that happens to be their brother Joseph. But they don't know that. So they come before him, and he's in charge of selling the food, and they have absolutely no idea that it's Joseph, the boy that they had sold into slavery. However, he recognizes them. Now, again, you read kind of between the lines. Did some of these underlings that the Pharaoh, that Joseph had, identify them? Or did he see them and recognize them? You just sit there and you wonder sometimes how it all came apart. Genesis 42, verse 6. It says, now Joseph was governor over the land, and it was he who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came, and they bowed down before him with their faces on the earth, or to the earth. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. Now I would submit that perhaps Joseph didn't extend love to his brothers either. We read elsewhere that he knew what they had done. He remembered that. He acted as a stranger and spoke roughly to them. Then he said to them, where do you come from? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them. And he said to them, I remember those dreams, remember? No, he doesn't. He begins to play some games with them. And he says, you are spies. And they were shocked. They said, wait a minute, we just came down to buy some food. You come to seek the nakedness of the land. And they said, no, no, my Lord, we just came to buy some food. We're starving down in Canaan. We are all one man's sons. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies. So they continue to try to convince him that they're honest men. But he plays out this game with them. Down to verse 16. He says, okay, I'll tell you what we're going to do. One of you can return home. The rest of you are going to go to jail. So he puts them in prison for 3 days. Verse 18. And then Joseph said to them the third day, well, do this and live. I've changed my mind. He says, do this and live. For I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison house. Excuse me. So he goes from putting them all in prison to just taking one of them. I want you to go home, is what he's saying. And then carry some grain to your family down there for the famine that you guys have down in Canaan. And then I want you to bring your youngest brother to me. So your words will be verified and you shall not die. And they did so. And then it says in verse 21, something kind of interesting. Then they said to one another, we are truly guilty concerning our brother. For we saw the anguish of his soul when we pleaded with him, with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. They look back 13 years or so, remembering what they did to Joseph. And Reuben answered them and said, did I not speak to you, saying, do not sin against the boy? And you would not listen. Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us. But see, they did not know, it says in verse 23, that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter. And when he heard this comment, he turned away and he cried. He's beginning to have a little sense of guilt himself, perhaps, that the love for his brothers is overcoming him. And then he returned to them and he said, I'm going to take Simeon. And he bound them before their eyes. Simeon is Jacob's second son, born to Leah. The brothers returned to their father and informed him of all that Joseph has said and done. And Israel, because Simeon is now in prison, Israel now grieves for Simeon. The brothers didn't return for some time, it seems like. And they had great trepidation because they wanted to go back and get more food, but they didn't have Simeon. He was back in Egypt. And now they're talking about, well, we've got to take Benjamin. So let's jump ahead to chapter 45. This is the point in the story where Joseph is going to tell his brothers who he is. So he's played this game with them back and forth. He's got them essentially where he wants them. They don't know who he is, but he knows well aware of who they are. It says in chapter 45, verse 3, then Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Does my father still live? But his brothers apparently were struck dumb. They could not answer him. His brothers could not answer him, for they were all dismayed in his presence. Joseph said to his brothers, please come near to me. So they came near, and then he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. Now, if you go back and read the story, some of which we hadn't covered today, in the various chapters of Genesis, from the very time that the brothers sold into slavery until this very moment in time in the story, Joseph has acknowledged the great God of the universe as the one controlling all the events. There are seven specific occasions where he acknowledges his reliance and trust in God and thankfulness. When he rejected the advances of Potiphar's wife, that was the first one. Interpreting the dreams of the baker and the butler. Interpreting Pharaoh's dream. Number four was when Manasseh, his son, was born. And the next one is when Ephraim was born. Then when he ordered the brothers to bring Benjamin to Egypt. And here, where he identifies himself to his brothers in Genesis 45, verses 5 through 8. He says in verse 6, for these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and therefore are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he, God, has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Now, as we know, the story has a very happy ending. In the next few verses, we learn that Pharaoh hears that Joseph's brothers are there, and he sends an invitation for them to come and live in Egypt. And Jacob and his extended family settle in the land of Egypt. But there's something else I'd like to have you consider for a moment. And here's the punchline I was talking about. As he sees them depart, going back to Canaan to get Jacob and all the other brothers and all the other siblings and people that are part of the family, he watches them go out. Verse 24. So he sent his brothers away, and they departed. And he said to them, this reading from the New King James, see that you do not become troubled along the way. And that's the verse I got kind of stumbled over as I read that. I said, well, what does it mean to become troubled along the way? Well, when I come across something like that, first place I normally look is in King James. Because sometimes there are things in the King James that may be a little bit cumbersome to read, but sometimes there are things that are made a little bit clearer in the King James than they are in the New King James. Rarely, but sometimes. So verse 24, the King James said, they departed, and he said to them, see that ye fall not out by the way. Well, that didn't help me a great deal. Not in this case. Well, I checked several recognized translations, and essentially they gave the idea that what Joseph was doing was encouraging them not to argue on their way home. The Bible in basic English says, see that you have no argument on the road. The New American Standard says, do not quarrel on the journey. The New Living Translation, don't quarrel about all this along the way. The RSV, the Revised Standard Version, says essentially the same thing. Don't quarrel on the way. And the Septuagint even says, be not angry by the way. Remember that Joseph knew what transpired among his brothers back in chapter 42. They did not know he could understand what they were saying to each other. Remember, this is where Reuben said, did I not speak to you saying, do not sin against the boy? And you would not listen. You know, there's some little contention there. Not brotherly love, but contention. Therefore now his blood is required of us. What Joseph is doing is reminding his brothers in this particular spot that they have all learned some lessons. And they need to consider those lessons. They all made mistakes. All is forgiven, however. He says that they should live together in brotherly love. Forget about it. God is always in control. Now that's my own paraphrasing. That same message is the one that Jesus Christ taught to his disciples, and by extension, to you and me. Let's turn to John. John chapter 13. This is during the Passover, the last one that Jesus had with his disciples on the earth. He introduced new symbols, and he gave new understanding of this assembly, this rite, this thing that we do on the Sabbath, on the Passover. And he continued to teach them and talk to them, help them understand. He says in verse 34, John chapter 13, verse 34, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another, as I have loved you, that you also love one another. Verse 35 then says, by this, all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. We have been called to embark on a journey that not everybody has been invited to attend. We're on a journey somewhere. We need to be changing. And we need to use some of the examples that we've been taught to help us to become more like Jesus and more like God. See, the earmark of the people on this journey that you and I enjoy is that they and we openly exhibit brotherly love. Turn to 1 John. 1 John chapter 2. Remember, John is the apostle of love. John, 1 John chapter 2, beginning in verse 3. Now by this we know that we know him, if we keep his commandments. What did he say back here in the epistle? In the gospel? A new commandment I give you, that you love one another. We don't have a choice. We need to love each other. Verse 4. He who says, I know him capitalized, and does not keep his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected in him. By this we know that we are in him. He who says he abides in him ought himself also to walk just as he walked. He gave his life for you and for me. Willingly, gladly. I think what Joseph was telling his brothers as they left Egypt for the last time was to embrace each other with brotherly love. The Apostle Paul gave us some examples of how we can demonstrate this love that we have for our brethren. Let's turn to the book of Romans. Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12, and we'll drop down to verse 9. This chapter is a fantastic chapter to read and study over and over again because it gives us a pretty good outline of what it means to be a Christian. Verse 9, let love be without hypocrisy. Don't fake it. Make it real and genuine. If you ask somebody how their week was, be interested in what they're telling you. Pray for them. We're all in this together. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. In honor, giving preference to one another. Not lagging in diligence. Fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another. Don't have favorites. Don't put people up on a pedestal. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion. Repay no one for evil with evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Show them brotherly love, even though they're not baptized members of the church. They're God's children, and they're going to have their chance. They're going to be our brothers and sisters later on. So do that with all men, not just people in the church, the people that you work with, clerks in the stores, some of these drivers that you wonder about what they're doing on the roads. You know, they haven't been called to this way of life that you and I have been called to. Now, in his second epistle, Peter states that sometimes Paul speaks of things that are hard to understand. That's in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10. And sometimes even people who read the New King James find it a little difficult to fully grasp some sections. The Living Translation, again, published by Tyndale House, sometimes makes it a lot easier to read the Bible. Let's read a few verses here in chapter 12 again, starting with verse 9. Don't just pretend to love others. Really love them. Hate what is wrong. Hold tightly to what is good. Love each other with genuine affection. And take delight in honoring each other. Never be lazy, but work hard and serve the Lord enthusiastically. Rejoice in our confident hope. Be patient in trouble. And keep on praying. When God's people are in need, be ready to help them. Always be eager to practice hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Don't curse them. Pray that God will bless them. Be happy with those who are happy. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with each other. Don't be too proud to enjoy the company of ordinary people, and don't think you know it all. Never pay back evil with more evil. Do things in such a way that everyone can see you are honorable. Do all that you can to live in peace with everyone. Now, God's plan included sending Joseph to Egypt to save Israel for a great deliverance. It included also calling Moses to lead Israel, along with a mixed company, out of the slavery of Egypt. That happened about 1400 BC or so. And it also included sending Jesus, the Messiah, to lead mankind out of slavery to a life of freedom and on to eternal life as members of the God family. That same plan, brethren, is in effect today. We, now, you and me, have got to practice and perfect brotherly love if we want to make it into the kingdom to be part of God's family. See, as we progress along this road we've chosen to travel, that God has called us to travel, I like to think what Joseph is saying when he says to them, not to argue, he says, take it easy on the journey. Try to get along with each other. I want to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 is known as the love chapter. I know it's read at most churches or weddings in the church. We talk about it, thinking about it being a relationship between a man and a woman. But God's love supersedes all that, or extends beyond that. It incorporates more than just the marital relationship. Paul says, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I have become a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal, just noise. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I'm nothing. Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not love, it profits me nothing. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. But whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect has come, then what that which is in part will be done away. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror, dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as I am also, or just also as I am known. And now abides faith, hope, love. These three. But the greatest of these is love.